Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Today on the show, we'll find out what makes people think it's okay to go up and pet a bison in Yellowstone National Park.
When the wildlife enters a human-developed area, people then change their view of that animal from being wildlife to a pet or a pest.
Scientists know little about frogs in Wyoming, but one project is hoping to change that.
It's valuable information because we still don't know where these guys all are and where they exist.
A rock climbing controversy in Tensleek Canyon has caused the Forest Service to step in and put a hold on route development.
We are going to be enforcing from this point forward.
Those stories and the mixed reasons people on the Wind River Reservation oppose some dumping that could get into a major waterway. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Tensleek Canyon has become a popular destination for rock climbers looking for adventure. But some are concerned that parts of their adventure might be manufactured. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports on a controversy that is starting to bring climbers together.
Tensleek Canyon sits on the southwestern edge of the Bighorn National Forest, and it's always been a destination for rock climbers. President of the Bighorn Climbers Coalition, Alex Green, says in the past couple of years, the area's popularity has exploded.
Tensleek Canyon has been seeing a pretty big resurgence in the rock climbing development over the last handful of years. And that resurgence has come with its share of pros and cons.
Green says more people have been developing rock climbing routes or paths up a rock in Tensleek. He says the rocks in there are limestone and it requires some cleaning before it's safe to climb.
You need to pull off loose flakes, loose rocks. You need to file down like razor sharp edges, make sure they're not going to cut you. Sometimes get rid of a little bit of vegetation if it's growing in the middle of the route. There's kind of like a minimal standard that absolutely needs to happen when you're developing limestone.
That's where climbers have had some differences in the past year. In 2018, climbers in the canyon started noticing that some of the newer climbing routes were looking a little too clean, something they call manufactured.
Instead of just filing down a razor sharp edge so a pocket doesn't cut you when you put your fingers into it, they might make the mouth of the pocket bigger so you can fit three fingers into it instead of two or something like that.
Green says his group started hearing about routes that had drilled holes for pockets, as well as some with rock that had been reinforced with a type of glue. That's led to a big conversation about what is considered ethical route development in the canyon. The man at the center of this controversy is Louis Anderson. Anderson has climbed intensely for more than 20 years and moved to the area about 4 years ago. He's developed around 150 routes since moving here and owns a local business that offers climbers a place to stay when they visit the canyon. Anderson says he met with local climbers and route developers about his behavior in June 2018.
And those conversations I thought went quite well, that initial meeting and then follow-up conversations over the following month or so kind of led me to reevaluate what I was doing and change my opinion on the tactics that I was comfortable using. And I told these people that. And from that point on, I haven't done those things.
Anderson says he spent the last year or so trying to regain the trust of the climbing community. But in February, several longtime Tensleek climbers brought more attention to the issue with a published open letter attacking Anderson's practices. Alex Green with the Bighorn Climbers Coalition says the published letter forced his group to react.
It necessitated a very direct response and a more public response, I think, than we were initially preparing for.
So the organization started holding route developer roundtables where climbers could get together and talk about what's been happening in Tensleek, which has led to them writing a guidance document for route development.
It's being written by members of the local community. We're getting input from everybody on all sides of this, and we're going to be coming up with a set of guidelines and standards that I think we can all be happy with moving forward.
But while it looked like the issues were being resolved, a group of people went to the canyon in the middle of the night and took down some of the routes Anderson had developed. Green says about 70 routes in the canyon were negatively affected.
30-ish were totally stripped and removed from the wall. They just don't exist anymore as routes. Another 30-ish were kind of partially affected. They put red padlocks on the first bolt of a lot of routes. a handful of roots. They filled in some holds that they thought were manufactured with epoxy, or broke some holds off the wall even.
The actions prompted the U.S. Forest Service to finally get involved. Powder River District Ranger Tracy Weaver says they will now be enforcing rules on root development in the canyon.
You can't go and manufacture, you can't create trails or routes or anything on national forests without a permit or an operating plan.
Weaver says they made the decision to put a pause on route development to give everyone a chance to cool down from the tension over the past year.
Basically, what it was, from my perspective, was to get everybody to take a tactical pause, to move forward more thoughtfully and on the same page.
The Forest Service has hired a ranger to solely focus on climbing. He'll be working in Ten Sleep to educate climbers on sustainable practices and taking an inventory of climbing routes and the impacts of climbing. Weaver says they'll also be working with climbers to finish up a climbing management plan for the forest.
We'll definitely work with them on the, you know, the route development ethics that they're working on right now. We'll make sure that there's information in there about the wilderness area and how we want to manage that. And then as well as, you know, addressing dispersed camping and human waste and dogs and, you know, all of the other impacts that people potentially have when they come to climb here.
The Forest Service granted the Bighorn Climbers Coalition $22,000 to start surveying the canyon as the first steps to getting the management plan. Last year, the coalition mapped trails and dispersed camping in the canyon. Currently, they've been working on an archaeological survey. There is no definite timeline on when a final management plan would be ready. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Ten Sleep.
Earlier this summer, the Northern Arapaho tribe came out against a proposal by the energy company Aethon to discharge oil field waste upstream of the Wind River, but not for the reasons that some tribal members would like. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr explains.
Micah Lott has lived in Arapaho, just south of the Big Wind River, for most of his 26 years, and he knows the river really well. So much so that he's named after it.
Yes. Me and my sibling are named after the two rivers, the Little Wind and the Big Wind.
Growing up, Lott spent a lot of time in these rivers, swimming in them and fishing in them.
And then realizing much later in my life that we were actually living by our tribe's oil fields, and that as long as I've been alive and longer, that they've been using these rivers for like discharge.
Lott is a citizen of the Northern Arapaho tribe, which along with the Eastern Shoshone operates 10 oil and gas fields on the Wind River Reservation. He's talking about this now because of Aethon Energy's proposal to dump some of its own wastewater into the Alkali and Badwater Creeks, which flow into Boisen Reservoir, which flows into the Big Wind River.
The justification for a lot of these places is that it's been happening for the last 100 years, it's been happening for the last 50 years. Now people are saying, hey, like, you know, it might have been happening, but we can't continue to allow this to happen because we're starting to see the effects on our families, you know. They don't want that to happen. Not anymore.
The Northern Arapaho tribe submitted a public comment saying it was against the proposed dumping, but not for the same reason as Lott. Ryan Ortiz, director of the Northern Arapaho Natural Resources Department, says it's about the reservation's economy. There are federal limits to the amount of pollution that can be discharged into the Wind River. And if Aethon is allowed to reach that limit with its dumping, Ortiz says that could get in the way of both tribes' economic development.
Yeah, it could stifle it for sure. We may not have the ability to increase production because it would cost too much to clean water.
So to be clear, the tribe isn't asking for less pollution. They want to leave open the option of expanding their own oil and gas production and doing some dumping themselves. At a panel event in Riverton last month, a young Eastern Shoshone woman named Jessica Swallow brought this up to tribal leaders. Swallow says that speaking up at the panel wasn't easy because she was speaking to her elders.
In our way, when you're a young person, you're not really supposed to stand up and talk. You're supposed to sit back and listen.
This tension between youth looking for action on environmental issues and elected officials who don't seem to share the urgency, it exists all over the world. But here on Wind River, young people have a really fine line to walk. Someday, Swallow says she wants to pursue a seat in tribal leadership and help her tribe become less reliant on fossil fuels. But for now, she has to be careful about how she advocates for that goal.
I have to say that first, like, look, I'm a young person, but I need to say something. This is what needs to be said. And so it was scary, but if I don't get up and say what needs to be said, then who's going to?
For his part, Eastern Shoshone Business Councilman Leslie Shakespeare says he hears Swallow's concerns.
Well, first of all, I would support any youth in whatever role they want to take in being advocates for the environment and for speaking out on climate change. And we also know that over the years, our reliance, we're going to have to wean ourselves off.
But Shakespeare says it's a balance. He's thinking about ways to diversify the reservation's economy down the road. But for now, there are tribal members who need help paying their bills and feeding their families. Jobs in the oil fields and oil and gas revenue in their monthly per capita checks can help with that.
Oil and gas has essentially been our bread and butter for our economy. You know, 85% of the money that we make goes to our tribal members, 15% runs our tribal government.
As for Atheon's proposed wastewater dumping, Shakespeare says the Eastern Shoshone tribe stands with the Northern Arapaho, that they oppose the dumping as long as it prevents the tribes from expanding their own production. Back at the river, Michael Lott says he wishes the tribes would oppose it more forcefully, and that they would take concrete steps to curb their own oil and gas production, so it wouldn't be hypocritical to ask energy companies like Atheon to do the same. But he understands why that's easier said than done.
We have to think of our own economic development and what that looks for our people. But essentially, where I stand right now is that I am actively opposing fossil fuel industry, and that includes like the further production of the resources that we have as well.
The State Department of Environmental Quality is in the process of reviewing Atheon's proposed wastewater dumping. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
Savannah Marr is a Report for America Corps member. When we come back, some people have concerns about an abundance of drones and an interview with the new dean of the UW College of Health Sciences. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. After serving as an interim dean, UW trustees recently named David Jones to become the new dean of the College of Health Sciences. Jones says despite the fact that he'd been an interim dean, the college has been moving forward.
We have been moving forward as a college in a lot of ways. I think our research mission has, we have increased that in within the last year. And that was one of the things I was hoping to do to help to facilitate for the college. One thing that's been stable is that we have good leadership in all the units in the college, and that has helped tremendously. We have people that have a great vision for their units. They work together well. We have, I think, a common vision for what the college can do, not only in terms of the students that we want to graduate to provide providers for the state and the region, but also what we think we can do as, I think, a key resource for healthcare in the state of Wyoming.
So many huge issues facing the state right now. Shortages is, of course, part of it, but also maybe getting a handle on how we're going to handle long-term care, things like that in the state. What are some of the focuses you hope to assist with?
Telemedicine, telehealth. Not that we will be necessarily providing those services, but we have, I think, the expertise to help the state to build that, to facilitate that. So we would maybe be more the conduit or the facilitator for it. We may be providing some services for the state as well, but I think we can really help to create a network of providers for the state with regard to telemedicine. We already have built a program. This is mainly out of the Wyoming Institute for Disabilities, whereby we have teleconferencing for providers to help them to develop their expertise in providing services around the state. So it's sort of a continuing education type of structure. And that has been growing and growing over the last year and a half to a great extent. So we want to continue to help the providers that are out there to be as proficient as they want to be in providing medical care, mental health services, substance abuse services around the state.
My read on it is it's sort of hit and miss. There's a lot of people that are very active with it, and some of the hospitals, because of their connections, are doing an awful lot, but then there's just still a lot of areas where it's foreign to people. They don't, both the providers and the patients. How do we get to that next level?
That's a great question, and I think I would like to be able to work with the Department of Health to help to try to solve that problem. Telemedicine is here. it is really, I think it's essential that we develop, I think, a solid structure within the state of Wyoming, whereby we can provide, the state can provide telehealth services to the citizens of the state. I think there are enough people around the state that are interested in doing it. There are some of the hospitals have begun to do it, but I think we can do it on a larger scale if we create a network of clinics and hospitals around the state. And there are some key people, I think, who are interested in doing that. It's a matter of sitting down, maybe doing an assessment of what the needs are, and then trying to problem solve and figure out how we create this network that will benefit everyone.
Can you tell me about some of the research that you're working on? I know there's an awful lot going on campus, but I was wondering maybe one or two things that strike you that might be very important for the state of Wyoming.
Absolutely. I think we have each of the units, I think, are doing some pretty interesting research. We have A few of our faculty in the College of in the School of Pharmacy who are doing work in neural regeneration, which is, I think, a big area that will have a huge impact in working with people with neurodegenerative diseases, spinal cord injuries, and so on. We have faculty in pharmacy and over in kinesiology and health who are doing work in heart disease, and hopefully working on prevention of heart disease. Part of it is related to exercise and exercise physiology. We have, speaking of telehealth, we have faculty who are doing some work with developing telehealth programs for individuals who have Parkinson's disease, so trying to manage and treat those individuals via telehealth. We have a faculty member who is doing some research on polycystic ovarian ovary syndrome, working with Native American women, and because there's a pretty high incidence of that condition. Physiology of addiction. We have a faculty member in pharmacy doing work in the physiology of addiction, substance abuse. So that's just a brief summary of some of the work that's going on here.
David, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
That was College of Health Sciences Dean David Jones speaking with Bob Beck. Changing gears, these days drones are everywhere. Soon, you'll even be able to get your Amazon deliveries with the company's Prime Air drone fleet. So how are we going to stop all these flying machines from flying into each other? Noah Glick has more.
Thank you. I'm standing in the old historic post office building in downtown Reno. A West Elm department store is now taking up the first floor, but upstairs, there's a makeshift command center. It's the drone world's version of an air traffic control tower.
It's a secure facility. You can't get up there unless you have secure access.
That's Chris Wallach. He heads up the Nevada Institute for Autonomous Systems. It's an official drone testing partner with the Federal Aviation Administration. Today, Wallach is leading a variety of drone test flight missions.
So on this display here, this is the picture of the drone radar. So it picks up all the drones that are flying here.
Right now, drone users, including hobbyists, already have a system, but it's limited. You have to see your drone at all times, can only operate it during daylight, and not over people. Wallach and his team are working with NASA, the FAA, and private industry to develop a new platform to allow pilots to fly their drones out of their line of sight autonomously. That's something the Amazons of the world want. Pointing to the screen, Wallach tells me this is the first time this system has been tested in urban environments, and that's a big deal.
And we have multiple drones stacked up on different airspace segments, flying on top of each other in their own designated airspace.
In one test, a drone takes off from the roof of City Hall and lands on a neighboring parking garage. In another, multiple drones fly simultaneously. The entire time, these machines are communicating back and forth with the system automatically.
This is kind of like the turning point for evolving the air traffic control network.
This project, known as the UTM system, will be for autonomous drones used by the military, government, and businesses. It began in 2015 and is led by NASA. Ron Johnson is the project manager.
Right now, the idea is that pilots would upload a proposed flight plan. And as many pilots do this, the automatic system that we're developing will take in those proposed flight plans and make sure they don't conflict with anybody.
NASA estimates that 700,000 drones will be in the airspace by next year. Johnson says that's just too many for the FAA's current traffic management system to handle. He says the UTM system will be more automated and offer better insights.
The system will be able to provide information about who is flying. So if John Q. Public's out there and they see a drone flying, the idea is that they would be able to go to an app or something like that and punch in some type of information about where they're located, what's going on right now, and they would be able to see a list of whose drone that is.
That sounds fun, but the bottom line of this project is safety. Jay Merkel is with the FAA arm of the UTM project.
We're about to introduce a notice of proposed rulemaking to require all drones to have essentially a license plate number that local law enforcement could look up your license plate, determine who the operator is, and get in contact with that person quickly.
He says that's to make sure people aren't flying drones where they shouldn't be, and if they are, they can be found quickly. This UTM system will eventually connect to other platforms, giving air traffic controllers a full picture of what's in the airspace. And as automated drones take to the skies beyond where pilots can see, Merkel says they need to be able to have some way to avoid running into buildings, power lines, or other drones.
So increasingly, we're looking at what technologies can replace the human doing that see and avoid function and ensure that drone can stay out of the way of manned aircraft.
NASA is scheduled to finish developing the UTM platform later this year after more urban testing. The system will then go to the FAA for implementation, which Merkel says will get rolled out over time. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
When we come back, we'll learn why some continue to pet bison and research about frogs and toads. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. In the past month, videos from Yellowstone National Park have gone viral, showing bison charging visitors. Bison-human incidents happen every season, sometimes causing injuries. The park is trying to figure out how to get the message across that the bison, elk, bears, and even badgers that people encounter in the park are wild, and they're also dangerous. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska tries to get a better understanding on why people continually get too close to wildlife.
There's a video online of a bison. The large, shaggy mammal is ambling alongside a hill eating grass. All of a sudden, the bull charges at a group of people about 5 feet away. Everyone is able to get out of the way except for a 9-year-old girl. She gets tossed into the air. The girl was injured and airlifted to a hospital. This video went viral earlier this summer.
Encounters occur almost on a daily basis.
That's Morgan Worthen. She's the public affairs specialist with Yellowstone National Park.
Wildlife incidents occur, probably safe to say, far too frequently, where probably on a given day, visitors somewhere in the park are getting too close to wildlife.
In Yellowstone, visitors are advised to stay 25 yards away from bison and elk and 100 yards from bears and wolves. Bison have injured more visitors to Yellowstone than any other animal. But that message never seems to get across. Kirsten Leong is a social scientist who has researched how human risk-enhancing behaviors increase visitor injuries. She says both animals and humans are guilty.
Animals learn that people are not threatening, and so they just stop responding to them. They just get used to them. They ignore them. They go about their business as if people weren't there.
This is called habituation. And biologists don't like to see this in wildlife. Leong says it allows people and animals to get closer to each other than they should. People see these huge lumbering beasts calmly walking right past cars or developed areas of the park, so visitors tend to think that these animals aren't threatening. Leong says just one person getting too close to a bison can cause a chain reaction.
If you have people who are seeing other people approach a bison and then think, oh, that they're doing it, it's okay for me to do, and then you start getting more people around them, that's when the animal's more likely to react.
That's because it begins to feel threatened by the number of people crowding around it. According to Leong's research, all of the reported bison injuries in Yellowstone from 2000 to 2015 were in developed areas. For Katie Abrams, the project lead on the Safe Wildlife Distance campaign, this makes sense.
People then change their view of that animal from being wildlife to a pet or a pest. So they might treat it as such. And so their risk perceptions are low.
The Safe Wildlife Distance campaign took research like Leong's and tried to create more effective messaging. Abrams says most people who are injured are trying to get that perfect shareable photo.
So we tried to frame keeping the safe distance from wildlife is not necessarily only preventing risk, but being very beneficial to your park experience. And so that was kind of the general approach to the long distance relationship is the best kind of relationship.
Abrams says they also found providing infographics with something visitors might be more familiar with helped people stay the correct distance from wildlife, like how many buses is 25 yards? That would be two buses.
When we go into a library, right, everybody sort of knows how to behave. It's quiet. We know to be respectful of others around us. I want people to come into a park and already have those social norms.
But she says enforcing those social norms still depends on that one person not getting too close to an animal. So when one visitor does do something stupid, with today's social media, it tends to go viral as the Today Show.
This video shows a man reaching over a fence to pet a bison at Yellowstone. At one point, the bison rears back.
After this happened, the National Park Service posted a graphic on its social media pages. A bison is chopped up into sections, which read, "Nope," "How fast are you?" "Vacation over?" and "Ouch." Abrams says this is a way to utilize an example of something not to do, to instill a positive social norm.
If I see that and I share that because I think it's funny, I'm sort of putting out there in the world, not only do I think this is funny and I get the social credit for that, but also maybe I get a little social credit because I know better.
The post has become the most popular of the summer. So next time a video goes viral of a visitor getting too close to wildlife, share it with your friends because their laughter might make someone else safe. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Boreal toads were once common in the western part of the United States. Today, the toads and many other amphibians are under attack from a deadly skin disease known as chytrid fungus, which limits their ability to obtain oxygen and may lead to cardiac arrest. But somehow, toads found in western Wyoming appear to be fighting back against the disease. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel has more about the two-man research team who is trying to put together the pieces of this puzzle.
Western Wyoming boreal toads are brown with a light stripe down their back. They're warty and hop around. And like other boreal toads elsewhere, 50 to 70% of the toads in this area have the chytrid fungus. But University of Wyoming researcher Gabe Barrill is trying to find out why they're not being wiped out by it.
What factors are causing the toads to be doing well in these streams versus, you know, other parts of their range?
Barrill has been studying these toads for about 5 years. Today, he's with his research technician, Matt Webster, in mountains near Pinedale.
Blows me away every day. This is our office. It's pretty great.
Similar to a doctor's checkup, they're weighing, measuring, and taking the temperature of each toad. The temperature is important because the researchers say the chytrid fungus grows in a specific temperature range.
And so we're sort of monitoring, you know, where the toad's body temperature is. And where, you know, toad digestion and immune function is the highest, if they can get their body temperature up to that level, they may be able to fight off the infection.
They also swab the toads with a long Q-tip, which will be sent to the lab to be tested for the presence of the fungus. One thing Barrill is looking into is when and where the fungus tends to be present, and if there's been any recent disturbances in the area that could affect its growth.
You know, if a wildfire warms up the environment in different ways, that could potentially have some sort of positive effect on how they're digesting food and growing and also their immune function. So, yeah, temperature and water relationships are sort of at the heart of most everything with these amphibians.
Another data point he looks at is the proportion of infected toads to healthy toads. There have even been toads who have had the fungus, but then gotten rid of it. These cases are particularly interesting and may shed some light into the way that the fungus can be effectively defended against. While we were driving between sites, he explained what management decisions can be made with this information.
But if you can sort of determine whether the amphibians have the ability to seek out these warm microclimates, and then maybe a simpler, smaller scale habitat manipulation, just to create more of those types of environments that they can go and sort of bask and raise their body temperature or dry out the fungus, could be a nice sort of effective yet feasible management tactic.
Counting tadpoles and newly emerged toads, which they call toadlets, is another part of the study.
So we're assessing tadpole growth, development, abundance through time, and trying to relate that to environmental conditions at the pond. So, you know, pond size, hydroperiods, number of aquatic predators in the pond, water chemistry.
They move carefully through the water and use a little silver clicker to keep track. Those numbers are also used to calculate data about life stages, survival rates, and future viability, which are important to know when determining the disease's effects. The team is planning one more field season to gather more data before final analysis, with the obvious goal of being able to determine what makes the toads able to fight off the fungus.
It's tough. It's a big puzzle. Fortunately, you can't do a puzzle all at once. You have to do little pieces.
Piece by piece.
For Barrill, this research is not only important because of the global conservation implications, but also because of a simple respect for living things. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
Staying with the amphibian theme, if you find yourself near a stream in the mountains or a pond in the prairie, you're likely to hear the rhythmic croak of frogs. They're all over Wyoming, but scientists here know very little about them. not where they live or what conditions they like best. This year, several organizations are working to change that. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports deep into the night with two scientists on the job.
The sun is starting to set over a gravel road next to a ranch south of Casper. The evening reflects purple in nearby puddles on the road. Project leader Katrina Cook is preparing for the first nocturnal call survey of the night. Cook speaks first.
You have your timer on you?
And that second voice was Becky Blankenship, Cook's field technician. Nocturnal call surveys are 3-minute intervals where the two scientists stand at a single spot and just listen for frogs, of any kind, in any direction. They're just interested to see if they're there at all.
It's valuable information because we still don't know where these guys all are and where they exist.
There are basic distribution maps, but none that are in-depth showing where these frogs are around Wyoming. There's so little information that most amphibians in Wyoming are considered a species of greater conservation need. That means there's too little data to even gauge these frogs' overall status. So, the Bureau of Land Management, in partnership with the State Game and Fish Department and Wyoming's Natural Diversity Database, organized a 2-season project to change that. Cook is leading the on-the-ground effort, collecting surveys around the state to make up that baseline data for Wyoming's frogs.
Ideally, we would know how numbers are for each species. We would know where to find them, how to find them best.
Eventually, this information will be available to land managers, like the BLM, to inform decision-making.
All that starts with nights like tonight. Cook has already highlighted potential frog habitats around the state. Tonight, Blankenship and Cook will survey 10 miles of that habitat, stopping at 22 sites overall for 3 minutes each. Just before 9 p.m., it begins.
Timer good?
Yep.
Okay, and start. And I think there's two. Yeah, okay.
Now they attend to bookkeeping. Cook and Blankenship discuss where they heard frogs, then use a compass to write down the directions, how many groups they were in. They also record temperature and humidity. By the end, maybe all these data will show a trend, like perhaps there are more frogs in warmer and humid temperatures. They write all this down. Auditory surveys like this one can only happen in the summer, because it's mating season. Those croaks you often hear are mating calls. But not all frogs croak.
All dudes. Yep. It's a boy band.
Okay. Next stop.
Next stop.
Then we get in the car and travel a half mile to the next site to collect more data. And then another half mile. You get the idea. And before too long, it's completely dark out.
Oh, shooting star!
That was cool.
Nice.
Cook doesn't drink coffee, but with the help of some sour candy, she says she's still feeling awake.
Better than I thought I would feel at 11 o'clock.
It's 11 already? Oh my goodness.
It is.
With no more sunlight, the temperature has dropped, and it's completely quiet. With no highway noise or residential hubbub, Cook and Blankenship are now deep in the prairie. And at one of our stops, you can really tell. Cook and Blankenship just stand there for a second to appreciate their surroundings. Back in the car, Cook says she appreciates the quiet of this work.
Well, to just enjoy silence is nice. But you're also getting to connect with nature in a way that not a lot of people get to. I mean, this job has us standing outside, you know, for 3 minutes. And all you're doing is focusing on what's around you auditorily. So, I don't know. Yeah.
It's now well past midnight. We've been out for about 5 hours, driven 9 miles, and done around 20 surveys. They finish up the last 3-minute interval, then it's back to the campsite.
Do kangaroos.
Tonight's 22 surveys and all the data collected from them will be compiled into a final report after the summer of 2020. It'll include a map so scientists can finally have a baseline of where all these species are, what kind of temperatures they like, humidity, whether their habitats have expanded or shrank.
The next study that gets added on to this one, you know, they'll be able to use this data to base and plan the next field seasons of whatever project they do. It's kind of like we're constantly, it's almost like we're a big team.
Tonight was one step towards collecting data that could have a big impact. It's 2:30 a.m. now. Everyone is very tired, but it's been a productive day at work. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Coming up, we'll hear a positive story about kids and the internet. This is Open Spaces.
You are listening to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. The internet has changed a lot of the things about the way we read, think, and do politics. And it's also changed the creative writing of teens. And spoiler, this is a positive story about kids and the internet. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones opens in the middle of things, or as a writer would say, in medias res.
My book is centered around two people's point of view after a tragedy occurs.
That's 16-year-old Kathleen Veldkamp from Cheyenne. Veldkamp just self-published a book through Amazon's Kindle Direct program. It's called 12-Sided Dice. And how long did it take you to write?
About a year and a half. I think the rough draft took me longest to make, and then the revision was a lot quicker.
Tiffany Rabine is English Language Arts Coordinator for the Laramie County School District. Lately, she's seen a lot more kids like Kathleen Veldkamp.
I actually had a gal. She came in with a book that she was working on publishing and has, you know, self-published individual ones. I have a little gal going into seventh grade. She took part in our writing camp. Her mom emailed me after camp and was like, yep, she has a short story that she's working at getting, kind of self-publishing that.
Rabine says the opportunity to self-publish online has completely changed how kids write.
What I've seen is kids not being as shy about sharing their writing, kids being more independent.
She says more than ever before, teens are writing outside of school, on their own, and for an online audience. It's a vulnerable thing, though, to put your writing out into the world, says Veldkamp.
I was a bit nervous publishing it because in 10 years, I might, hate the book that I wrote and be embarrassed by it, but I like that I at least tried to do it and that I did do it.
Personally, I would love to find the novel I wrote at 14 about rival vampire gangs in Los Angeles. 15 years ago, when I was a teenager, my friends and I would post stories and poems online. The website still exists. I reached out to my friends from that era, but none of us could remember our old usernames. My friend Liz said, to be honest, she hopes that stuff stays buried. Still, I perused the archives. As an adult, clicking through thousands of pages of poems about friendship betrayals or mental illness or falling in love, modern-day retellings of obscure Greek myths, or stories about bananas taking over the world, I was amazed at the outpouring of emotion and creativity.
Because the kids who do this are really serious about it, and so they're going to want a quality outlet.
Rabine says that keeps these sites nurturing, so kids feel safe to be honest. For me, it was like instant community and an incubator for ideas. You write something you think is decent, you post it, you leave comments on other people's work, and they leave comments on yours. It was key to me becoming a real writer. To this day, I abide the good advice from the girl that said, "Nice poem, just remember and is a weak line opening."
Kids would come in and, "Hey, I spent some time writing this, will you read it? And I have some online friends also reading it."
It's hard to say when the first self-published book came out, but by no means is it a new concept or one relegated to amateurs. The Joy of Cooking, The Tales of Peter Rabbit, both DIY affairs. But back then, those writers had to pay big expenses for their book to be printed. Now, with the internet, you need way less capital, like Veltkamp, self-publishing through Kindle Direct. And writers have always shared their work with each other. Consider the Bronte siblings, writing stories and plays to entertain each other over long, lonely nights on the English moors. Those stories gave birth to Heathcliff and Jane Eyre. But now people can share their work and get feedback and talk craft, even if they didn't grow up in a writerly household, even if they live in a small town, even if they've never met anyone else who carries a notebook everywhere they go. And eventually, their creative incubation online can pay off in real life, like Veltkamp's novel, 12-Sided Dice.
I think it was really cool to see my family and friends and even fellow students and teachers read something that I've written, and they've all liked it so far.
If you were a 16-year-old in, you know, like 1985 who couldn't self-publish necessarily on the internet or self-publish at all, what do you think you would do if you were you in 1985?
I don't know. I have never lived in 1985. I might never have published a book.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Erin Jones.
Maria came to the U.S. illegally with her mother when she was a little girl, so they could meet up with her father, who was working in the country legally. When StoryCorps came to Jackson last summer, Maria told her son Jordan about how she ended up in Idaho.
We had to cross the border because we still didn't have the permit to come over the United States. At that time, in 1992, the border wasn't that dangerous like how it is right now. We just hike up a mountain, hike it down, went to a hotel. We stayed there for a whole day until the afternoon. Somebody came and picked us up and drove us to Salt Lake City. Finally, my dad picked us up in Salt Lake City. We came to St. Anthony, Idaho. That's where my life started all over again. Everything was new. So we made it happen. We're still here. A year ago, my husband and me, we accomplished buying a house to the other side of the mountain. It's been hard, too. We go back and forth, but we have something. We have a land. We have a house. We're working hard for it, and it's not for us, but it's for my kids, too.
I feel really comfortable where I am, and I really don't want it to change. Because I've made a lot of friends, like a lot.
Well, that's pretty cool. I'm really happy to hear that after 5 years of struggle and now starting. So they worked out from one way to another. Life, it's not easy, but you can accomplish your goals.
That's Maria and her son Jordan talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. This piece was produced by Alex Schaefer. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear a segment again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Most of this week's stories can also be found on our station Twitter and Facebook pages. Anna Rader is our web editor. Don't forget, you can also get the podcast version of Open Spaces wherever you get your podcasts.
We will be taking the next couple of weeks off to bring you a special on education. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.